Greetings and welcome to Flanagan's Ecologic. I am your host, Ted Flanagan, and today I'm joined by Jonathan Parfrey. This is his second time on the podcast. He is the founder and the executive director of Climate Resolve, an organization working to make Los Angeles safe and sound as we adapt to climate in our region. Jonathan is an inspiration to many. He's a huge networker, one of the most popular people I know. Really happy to have Jonathan on the podcast today. Hey, Jonathan, welcome to the podcast. It's good to see you again. How are you today?
I'm very well, Ted. Good to see you.
And you're back from Climate Week, right?
I am. In fact, I'm back at the LA Clean Tech Incubator in downtown LA. And our organization put on a major event at Climate Week. And we stayed for the rest of the week. And I spoke at a few other venues. And it was a lot of fun.
Talk about your event, and then what was the focus of your event, and then I want to hear more about the whole week.
Well, our organization has been involved in trying to popularize how reflective surfaces, like cool roofs, cool walls, and cool pavements, not only help cool down buildings and neighborhoods, they have a global benefit as well, which is sending solar radiation back into space. We're, as you know, with climate change, we have an excess, a surfeit of energy on Earth that has been rebounded by greenhouse gases back to the surface. And what if you have the right kind of surface, you can rebound sunlight to not be captured by the greenhouse gases, at least not to the extent that they are currently, and it goes directly out into space. And may I add, at the speed of light, you don't have to wait for modeling over 15 years. You can figure it out instantaneously. And it's a way of trying to fix the energy imbalance that we currently have on Earth. And that, for me, is very exciting.
And
so that was our event.
Your contribution. But it seems as though Climate Resolve is really at the cut. You have been personally for years, this cool services movement. And it seems like it, is it not, are you finding that you're a lone voice out there?
No. There are other organizations that are looking at cool roofs and cool surfaces as mainly a benefit related to the urban heat island effect. And indeed, that is the case. In fact, the great Art Rosenfeld, when he was at the California Energy Commission, introduced cool roofs as a means of reducing the energy use in a building. And the return on investment is like instantaneous. The cost of cool roof materials have come down considerably. They're basically at a par with traditional roofing asphaltic materials. And I think it's kind of a no-brainer to have it in your home to save money. We have California energy codes associated with cool roofs with certain solar reflective standards for both flat roofs and slanted roofs. And we, in the city of LA, our organization advocated for a more stringent cool roof standard, which we achieved many years ago. But most of the other organizations are looking at cool roofs. There's a cool roof rating council. There's other nonprofits involved in that. But when it comes to the CO2 equivalence of sending sunlight back into space, you are right. Climate Resolve is on the cutting edge of that. And I don't know of another organization that is articulating the benefits of the cool materials on a climate mitigation message. And I kind of like that. I like the fact that from our really humble LA specific on the ground work that we have done, where we have put, you know, many hundreds and through policy, tens of thousands of cool roofs out in the LA area. We are now taking that experience and bringing that information more globally.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Back to Climate Week. It sounded like there were 600 events or 800 events. I mean, extraordinary. 900. I mean, the number keeps going up. So How does that work? What is it like being there? How many people, how do you choose? I mean, you have your own event, of course, but then how do you choose what to do?
Well, I know this podcast is going to go out more globally, and I'm going to get in trouble for what I'm about to say. But there are public events, and there are many private events. The private events are significantly more interesting and have content. Hmm. There are some public events that are wonderful. I went to some where our friend Terry Tamman from Alta-C was presenting with Jet Propulsion Lab climate scientists. And it was really interesting sea level rise information that was being presented. Dr. Josh Willis, the scientist at JPL, kind of an amazing guy. And so one of the nice things about going to New York is hanging out with Californians. So I got to see these Californians. And I also got to see some of the legislative folks that were in town. So the Senate Pro Tem, Senator Henry Stern, what a great guy. Senator Ben Allen. And we had Assembly Member Luz Rivas, who came to our event and presented. She is anticipated to win her race in November 5th to become a member of Congress. We had Senator Blake Spear of San Diego County came and participated in our event. It was kind of nice to have this large California contingent there. And I even saw some people from RMI. You ever heard of those guys?
I have. And wasn't Hurricane Helene happening right at the same time?
By the end of the week, yes. We had our event on Monday. The whole thing kicks off on a Sunday. We had it on Monday. We were kind of done. I gave a talk on Thursday at the New York Association of Architects and American Institute of Architects. And that was a lot of fun, too. And I went to a great event at the New York Federal Reserve Bank, where they were bragging that they had more gold on site than Fort Knox. I don't know if I would brag about that. But it was a lot of great information, a lot of great contacts. I felt it was very much worthwhile to attend.
Overall, was the tone optimistic, or is it just all across the board in terms of pessimism, optimism, emotions?
Their focus was amplifying a public health message throughout the climate week this year. And so there was a special focus on public health. And I think that's a great message, because either we make the changes we need to make, or public health is really in the crosshairs.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned Art Rosenfeld earlier, who was somebody I knew quite well back in the day, and then our mutual friend Michael Totten, one of my very best friends who you've met, was on vacation in France for the past couple weeks, and then got back last night to Atlanta en route back to Asheville, and then of course can't even fly back into Asheville.
Nope.
And they moved to Asheville what 3 or 4 years ago, thinking that it was probably a pretty safe place to be in the scheme of things. But talk about how Asheville is just playing right into what Al Gore talked about in the Inconvenient Truth all those years ago, right?
Yeah. You know, I try to sometimes put the climate crisis in my own words, and sometimes it may not make the most scientific sense, but I think I'm grasping the concepts generally. And what we've done by putting these aerosols, particulates in the atmosphere, is that they do a really good job of reflecting infrared energy, heat. And it doesn't just bounce it back to Earth, it bounces it everywhere. But the important part is the stuff that gets bounced back to Earth. And we've been adding watts per square meter of additional energy over the course of the last 130 plus years. And now it's accumulated to the point that we have a lot of energy on Earth that we didn't used to have. And so these extreme events, that would have been negligible 10, 20 years ago have turned into significant events.
Yeah. Yeah. More frequent, more ferocious, less predictable, right?
Indeed. When it comes to heat waves, each and every year it's getting warmer. And that is one of the things that our organization focuses on is extreme heat beds. And you know this, and you've probably had some of our staff members on here with you to talk about
it. I have, thank goodness. Well, what degree can you, as an organization, a nonprofit organization, get involved with politics, get involved in advancing different candidates? I think Forbes, there's a quote in Forbes magazine somewhere that one needs, as a 501c3, one needs to toggle back between your private life, which I guess is your own, your political opinions, and then your public life, or your nonprofit life. How do you navigate that? I know you have so much interest in.
I was looking for a hat behind me so I could take on a hat and take it off again, but I don't have it here. But at Climate Resolve, as a nonprofit entity, we cannot endorse any candidates, and we cannot sort of demonize other candidates that we don't endorse. It can't happen. And what we can do, though, and this is totally permissible by the IRS, is that we can analyze candidates for their attentiveness, for their voting record, for their statements associated with various things. So we could evaluate candidates based on their environmental record or climate record. We actually don't do that. We want to truly stay away from any accusations of interfering in the election of individuals. Mm-hmm. However, when it comes to measures, when it comes to propositions, we can take a position. And our organization, indeed, is taking a position this November for a California member measure, Proposition 4. Some people have called it a climate bond. I don't know about that. But it has some climate element.
It's got a funny name. What is it? The Safe Drinking Water, Wildlife Prevention, Drought Prevention, and Clean Air Bond Act.
That is exactly right. Yeah. And it has, it puts a lot of money towards water. But I was talking with my friend, Tracy Quinn, who is the director of Heal the Bay. And she goes, even though water gets the vast majority of Prop 4 money, $3.8 billion. She goes, it's just like a drop in the bucket of what we need to secure people's water supply. And I'm thinking, our extreme heat measures in there, the one program we're working on is slated to get $50 million. And I hope it passes. And I hope that money goes through with some additional funds as well for extreme heat. And I might complain even a little bit that, the trail maintenance budget is going to get $60 million in this. So there's going to be more money going to trail maintenance. Plus, I hike. We've hiked together, Ted.
Sure.
We love hiking.
We like hiking.
Trail maintenance, good. But the program that's protecting Californians for heat is getting $10 million less than trail maintenance. I think the priorities are a little screwed up, but we're still supporting it anyway.
And is there a lot of opposition to that measure?
Not really. I think the electorate is of a mood of, do I trust the government with my money, and do I trust them to do the right thing with my money? I kind of understand that mood. Being close to the sausage making, I could probably supply a few examples of where people would be hesitant to give the government more money. But I think on the balance, yes, this is a very good thing.
Great, great. I'm shifting gears completely. You served on the board of commissioners for Los Angeles Department of Water and Power for 5 years, I think it was.
Yes.
Back around 2008 to 2013, that was 10 years ago. And DWP, really, you thank you for all you did transforming that utility. It's become a leading utility. But you're concerned about its goals or the attaining the goals by 2035 of being a zero carbon, having a zero carbon footprint. Is that right?
Yeah. In fact, I'm an appointed member of a committee looking at the city's ability to get to a sort of a carbon neutral energy delivery system by 2035. And so you have to ask yourself, is 2035 an important date? Is it important for the nation's largest municipal utility to become carbon neutral in its energy delivery? 10 years before the state of California is supposed to, the state of California is by law, is supposed to get there by 2045. And Mayor Eric Garcetti set a target for us to get there by 2035. NREL, the National Renewable Energy Lab out of Boulder, has come to LA and has done an extensive study on what it would take given the current grid requirements and the possible sources of energy and what that would look like. And they came to the conclusion that you need in basin to balance out the grid, the energy has to be generated here, in basin generation. And the only way to get there that is carbon neutral is by using green hydrogen in peaker plants. And do we look to battery storage? I think we do. But when it comes to peak use, are there enough batteries to get us out of that problem? And it's an important question to ask. And in addition to that, given the transition away from natural gas in buildings, the transition away from gasoline with our vehicle fleets and our home vehicles, given that AI and blockchain are expanding, and just for data centers, I think, Ted, you even wrote about this. Looking at like conservatively doubling the energy use of data centers by 2030 over what they are today. Conservatively, yeah. It could be higher. So we have to ask ourselves, if 2035 is the date, and I think it should be, I'm an activist. I want it to happen sooner. I love the idea that LA's in front and we're showing the world that it can happen. Do we have to reckon with the fact that we might have to combust some hydrogen? And I think we have to countenance that as a possibility.
And why would that be a bad thing if it's green hydrogen, which means it's produced with renewables? Why would combusting it be a bad thing?
Here, I'll tell you.
Sounds expensive. Sounds expensive, but go ahead.
Oh, it's expensive. Yeah, but here's why it's a bad thing. It has to do with air toxicants, and the hydrogen burning it by itself is not a problem. If it's a closed system and there's no air getting into that process, but that's not the way it works. So if you're combusting it, you're burning the air as well. And there's nitrogen in our air, and you burn the nitrogen, you're creating NOx. And then the NOx is emitted and it combines with sunlight and heat and it creates ozone. And so there is real concern among the environmental justice communities of being downwind of those
stacks, whatever they are.
The stacks. And are there, you know, investments on filters? Are there investments as scrubbers to ensure that nitrogen oxide is being captured and not emitted, and so it won't convert? And I think it's an important question to ask. And frankly, the question isn't can we get to perfect, but can we get to much better than where we are today?
Would the use of green hydrogen be better than the use of natural gas?
No. There's some studies that indicate that the NOx created by hydrogen would be produced in greater quantities than even the NOx created by burning natural gas.
Wow.
Paradoxically.
Okay. Yeah.
And so we have to be alert to the technology. There have to be some developments so that the people who are downwind have cleaner air in 11 years than they have today. Now, I happen to live in downtown LA. I'm near two interstates. I'm breathing in way worse air than anybody who's downwind of Scattergood or Valley Generating Station or Haines in Long Beach or Harbor in Wilmington. Trust me, they have much cleaner air than what the vast majority of us are getting, but it's still not an excuse. And we should ensure that the LA municipal, department of water and power make sure that that is as clean as it could possibly be. But given some of the other constraints to meet that 2035 standard, because if we're relying on other technology like weights that would go down into oil wells, that is not a mature technology. I just, as you know, with utilities, their number one job is reliability, period. Number one, keeping the lights on. And I think that is a very important, should be a very important criteria for environmentalists as well.
Yeah, yeah. Just had Barry Cinnamon on the program, on the podcast last week, and he's a great solar thinker and runs a solar company up north. And he was saying that PG&E's rates have gone up 52% in the past 2 years. So there's this whole, there's a whole pressure also on rates going up and ratepayer advocates battling green measures. It's a balancing act, right?
Yeah, there are things more expensive than trying to stop climate change. I think it's climate change is maybe more expensive than that. So
yeah, right.
There are good economic studies that show that if you don't do your part in reducing emissions, then you will pay multiple times that in the future. So I think we're trying to do the right thing.
Yeah, yeah. You have done, as an organization, you've done lots of planning. LA County Climate Vulnerability Assessment, Sustainability Plan, Long Beach Climate Action Plan, Adaptation Plan. You've done a lot of plans. And then you're also involved with implementation, right? You've got both sides of the equation.
Yeah. And to tell you the truth, we love planning. Has to happen. But I want us to view it through a political lens. And I think this is an interesting idea. There is a political benefit to saying you're doing a plan because it creates the impression that you're doing something. Now, Ted, you've done plans. I don't think you would ever assert that a plan is the end goal. It's a guide to implement. But I think politically we use plans as a way of saying that we're taking action. I don't think a plan is taking action. And I actually think you learn a lot more by doing than you ever learn by creating a plan. I think plans are great. I'm not denigrating it, but I think that we have a misalignment because plans are so much cheaper to do. And politically, you have a cheap thing that makes it look like you're active.
That's a good point.
Rather than actually doing something that is expensive. And when you do that expensive thing, I swear you learn. Like, I'll give you an example. So we've been working on a resilience hub in Boyle Heights. And programmatically, that program has just been killing it. It's like working with the youth, training up the staff at the Boyle Heights Arts Conservatory, this great organization right there on Cesar Chavez near Soto. Just amazing. And the community comes in and the information that gets disseminated, absolutely positively, it has increased the resilience of the Boyle Heights community. However, part of that vision of a resilience hub is putting solar on the roof and having backup energy if the grid goes down, so that at this hub itself, it can continue vital services. They happen to have a radio station there. Imagine that great benefit. Like, think of like what's going on in Carolina right now, and in Tennessee, and in Georgia. Like, communications is absolutely essential when it comes to these emergencies. And people are listening to the radio in those places to get the information that they need. And the same will be true for Southern California when the time arises when we have a disaster. And so we love this idea that we're going to have solar and backup energy to keep the radio station going for days and some air conditioned use in this facility. Love it, love it. Oh my God, has it been hard to get the solar on that roof? It has been, it has taken years, Ted.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we have a private landlord who wants to do things his way. We've even gone out and gotten the roofing materials donated. We've gotten the solar straps donated from Jonathan Port.
Jonathan Port, yeah.
We still can't get that thing built.
Yeah.
It's cracking me up. And so we're still working on it. And we've gotten funded to complete this resilience hub. But programmatically, we've had grand slam after grand slam success. The infrastructure of the actual hub has been a frickin' nightmare.
Yeah.
And so we've learned from it. And so I can tell you things that should never be done at a resilience center or resilience hub in the future with absolute certainty.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't know until you do it.
And are you suggesting that you're going to shift from being a planning organization to an implementation, or are you just going to do both?
No, we're going to do both. I just wanted to just like plant the seed that there's things that are preferable, and I think you learn more by doing than by planning.
Yeah. What, when you think about Climate Resolve and your run at Climate Resolve, what are a couple of the projects that you've been that you're the most proud of? I know the Boyle Heights. I talked about it with Kat and and we've sort of dug in on that, which is an amazing project. What else comes to the top of your mind?
I think you also spoke with Enrique Huerta from our shop, and I'm really proud of the indoor workplace temperature maximums that we helped establish through Cal OSHA. Boy, that was a long, hard fight. And the thing that made it a little bit sweeter is that we were the only climate environmental group at all. Everyone else was organized labor. And that kind of, in my view, that's real solidarity. When you help people actually get some tangible wins, rather than by marching somewhere or by signing a letter or, you know, raising your fist, I prefer getting it done. And I feel really good about that. And I think that's going to, you know, protect people's health and maybe even save some lives. Really excited about that. Another project I'm proud of is a lawsuit that we filed. And this was to stop the high desert corridor. It was a freeway that was being envisioned to go from Palmdale all the way out to Victorville in San Bernardino County. And we were only opposing the freeway portion. There is still planning a way to have a rail line that might go through that area. But we were trying to stop the sprawl of Southern California and to constrain it. And I think that was a big win when we won that lawsuit to put that project in deep freeze where it is now.
And just, it sounds like just more of the same from you, right? Organization is cranking. You got lots of projects. You've got lots of really able staff. You've got a good board that's directing you. More of the same, right?
Thanks for saying that, Ted. And to tell you the truth, listen, we're kind of an organization that's scrappy. We're trying to go between the cracks that other people aren't talking about. So on that solar reflectance piece, as you noticed, no one else is doing that. And I kind of like the idea that we can fill that gap. You know, we started a what's called a supporting organization that is affiliated with Climate Resolve, but not we're not directly in control of it. And it's called Zero Emissions Transit. And that is a group that is championing the aerial gondola from Union Station to Dodger Stadium. And that would operate 365 days a year. And if people are going to a Dodger game, they wouldn't need to buy the fare. It would be provided for free of charge. And people in the local community would also ride for free, or if they worked in that community. I see that as a tremendous benefit of getting, you know, many tons of GHG out of the city. But the reason why we're really supporting it is that it would be inspiring in the same way that we participated in Ciclovia in the early days. We think that this is a new form of transportation that would inspire Angelenos to leave their car at home and take public transit more frequently. And that's why we're supporting it. And we've taken some heat for it because a large foundation called the California Endowment has its headquarters along the route. And they object to a tower being erected near their corporate headquarters.
Yeah.
And so they've asked all their friends that they funded over the course of decades to speak out against the project. But the merits of the project are enormous. And that's why we're proud of our participation in that. But again, that's kind of like Climate Resolve filling a gap that other people haven't done. And we are not necessarily risk adverse, as you know. We're willing to go in there and take a chance because we're facing, you know, climate change. We have to do what we can in the face of this overwhelming tsunami of hurt that is coming unless we take a strong and bold action. So we're experimenting with taking strong and bold action. And we're getting beat up a little bit, but it's the right thing to do.
Well, thanks for taking the heat. I totally agree. I commend you what you're doing, and I totally agree that we need bold action. And having a scrappy organization like Climate Resolve tackling some of these thorny issues is all good for me. Jonathan, thank you for being on the podcast. Thanks for what you're doing at Climate Resolve, and we'll do it again.
And Ted, I just want to say you're responsible for us growing as an organization. And in our early days, you were literally the crucial key that unlocked our growth. And I just want to thank you for everything you've done.
Yeah, well, that's very nice to hear. You're welcome.
Good.
Carry on.
Thanks, Ted.
Thank you. That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's Ecologic. We'll see you next time.